loud anymore. It's very odd. Prior to the David Bowie, it's funny, I was just reading, are we out? We are. Bye. It was Roxy Music. Stay tuned for the Global Research News Hour. Sorry if it was we're a second late on that. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we will talk to you next week.
Is there any opposition within the Canadian Parliament to the scheme the World Health Authority is poised to put into place? How does the WHO plan to use protecting public health as a vehicle for full control over our lives and the relinquishing of our civil liberties? What actions have been taken to register the non-approval of 8 billion people over the plans of a few thousand? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we are examining the complex plans moving forward at the World Health Organization this coming week, which, according to critics, would radically alter the way the state organizations in charge of public health gain control of our lives. We first hear from Michelle Leduc-Catlin, a former spokesperson for the National Citizens Inquiry, Canada's response to COVID-19, about her coming trip to Geneva and how she is attempting to help build bridges across the globe for public health against private tyranny. In our second half hour, we have an extensive discussion with medical expert Dr. Meryl Nass about her own investigation into the package of reforms, what it would mean to our own freedoms, and how we can fight back. On this week's program, the rise of COVID 2.0, beware the WHO's pandemic industrial complex. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 24th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program features on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland, long before plans by fascist governments in the 20th century or the renewed version today, the European settlers imposed new orders on Indigenous people at odds with their own rights and human decency. Let us completely reverse the patterns of colonialism and genocide and work to honor agreements that we had with the first people of the land to secure the assets that we are blessed with today. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. This practice assured that, gradually, all the wealth of society would inevitably accrue to the bankers, especially when they gained the privilege of creating paper money or book entry credits, quote, out of thin air, unquote, and then lending it at interest. This was the greatest crime of the ages. We need to remember that the Christian era began when Jesus made his last visit to Jerusalem by going to the temple and throwing out the moneylenders who had desecrated it. The temple symbolizes, of course, all human God-given life. When usury became widespread after 1500, citizens gradually lost all their rights and their human sanctity when they became debtors to the moneylenders and were legally mere chattel whose entire well-being and even their lives, debtors' prisons, were sacrificed to the banker's greed. That comes from the article, Usury, the Crime of the Ages, quote, Banker's Greed, unquote, by Richard C. Cook, posted May 22nd, originally published on the author's Substack, Three Sages. Two bloody conflicts are being waged in Ukraine and Gaza, Palestine, with blood, deep, dark blood, all over the Western world's quote-unquote leaders' hands, faces, and minds, almost all of them quote-unquote implanted into their leader role by Klaus Schwab. As Schwab boasted on several occasions, quote, "We are proud having been able to infiltrate governments around the world with our young global leaders," or YGL, unquote. To mention just a few, Gates, Schwab protege and international vax czar, Merkel, Germany, Trudeau, Canada, Macron, France, Rutte, Dutch, Jacinda Ardern, New Zealand, and many more. The future of the WEF remains to be seen. That comes from the article, WEF's Klaus Schwab Steps Back. What does it mean? Peter Koenig. By Peter Koenig, posted May 23rd. They are trying to ignore Jasanovec altogether, or quote-unquote cancel it, in contemporary parlance. I am referring, of course, to the Srebrenica resolution, now before the General Assembly of the United Nations. It misrepresents and, by disgusting virtue signaling, purports to, quote-unquote, memorialize a phony, politically fabricated genocide whilst ignoring a genuine genocide that actually did take place in the recent past and in relative geographical proximity to Srebrenica. If highlighting a Balkan genocide for the purpose of universal condemnation had been the real concern of the sponsors of the UN resolution, they would not have chosen as their focus a highly dubious example which pales by comparison to a genocide that is unquestionably real. Such a genocide occurred in Croatia, and you come together every year to pay homage to its victims. That comes from the article, UN General Assembly ignores a real genocide in Jasenovac to highlight a phony one in Srebrenica, by Stephen Karganovich, posted May 23rd. What began as the removal of obstacles to their law firm's clients ended in an anti-communist crusade in which the brothers became believers of their own propaganda. Today, the revival of this propaganda again positions Washington at sword's point with Russia and China. Anti-Russian propaganda is so much a part of Washington's consciousness that it appears to be embedded, continuing to cause foreign policy mistakes and overthrows of countries. Washington's overthrow of Ukraine has led to an ever-widening war, the consequences of which remain to be seen. The legacy of the brothers might well be nuclear Armageddon. That comes from the article, Did the Dulles Brothers Seal Our Fate? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 22nd, originally published on the Institute for Political Economy. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. If you consume Western press reports and were asked about where personal freedoms, human rights, and democracy were in peril, you would probably name one of the districts facing so-called authoritarian rule from rival states like Russia, China, or Iran. Or maybe you are considering the plight of the people of Gaza facing Israel's genocidal march, or civil disobedience activists on university campuses that are unjustly being brought down by police. Maybe you even have concerns about the dictatorial role of Donald Trump, should he be reelected in November. But there is one front that is definitely not considered by mainstream media, and that is the World Health Organization. The World Health Assembly is meeting in Geneva, Switzerland this coming week. This body plans to come to a major package of amendments to the international health regulations and the adoption of a new pandemic agreement. Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said these changes would benefit from the collective experience in managing multiple public health emergencies, including the COVID-19 pandemic, in order to strengthen the response for all 196 state partners and, quote, to protect every person in the world and future generations from the impact of epidemics and pandemics with a commitment to equity and solidarity, unquote. That sounds promising and effective. We don't want to repeat past mistakes in terms of the way we managed the pandemic. However, as was the case with wanting to institute the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Mutual Agreement on Investments, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and other such agreements, the devil is always in the details. Over the course of this program, we discover that the pandemic agreement, combined with revising of the 2005 international health regulations, essentially becomes a power grab by the elite financial sector. We frequently think of the military-industrial complex and brutish individuals ruling over us by force of power. We don't think of benign entities like the World Health Organization as being behind this new rule. But we had a sample of this power during the three-year-long pandemic. This would seem to be the weapon of choice among the very rich and powerful. The WHO has been, over the years, taken over by wealthy interests such as Bill Gates. It turns the WHO from an advisory body to a governing body. Should it be completed by the end of next week, they would have the ability to overrule member states and take away their ability to govern over healthcare, forcing them to agree to the rule of the WHO. It would constitute the relinquishing of our rights if we do not completely comply. This includes restricting speech, restricting press, restricting our right to gather, and other rights, all based on whatever this public-private partnership determines constitutes another pandemic. COVID 2.0, COVID ad infinitum, vaccine passports could be back on the charts. All these ideas that many Canadians and many people around the world had a difference of opinion and sacrificed a great deal to oppose in the past, they've not gone away. At least that is the opinion of the guests we plan to talk to this week.
Well, you may remember my first guest from about a year ago. Michelle Leduc-Catlin was then the spokesperson for the National Citizens Inquiry into Canada's COVID-19 response. Today, she's preparing to travel to Geneva, Switzerland, to participate in something called the Geneva Project. The project involves a rally outside where the World Health Organization is gathering to try to put forward a new pandemic agreement and a number of revisions to the international health regulations that a number of people believe will go from promoting health to controlling public health actions, thereby undermining the sovereignty and freedoms of the participant countries and in ways that may not benefit the people. Michelle is one of the people speaking at the rally on June 1st, and she joins me now to tell us more. And Michelle Leduc-Catlin, welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour.
Thank you so much, Michael. I have to correct something in your introduction. So I am participating in the leadership summit, but I will not be speaking per se, although I may be reading. I will be reading part of a Declaration of Independence. So you're kind of right.
Okay. Yeah. I just noticed that your name was featured on the banner of speakers, but that's fine. Thank you for that clarification. Now, the NCI, which ran last year, it's been a vehicle for allowing the people of Canada an opportunity to register their opposition to the various measures taken to address the COVID-19 crisis. Now, how did you move from there to this next step of bringing the findings to the international stage through the Geneva Project?
Yes. So while I was obviously traveling across the country, hearing all this testimony, I was reporting on it every night. And then, of course, I was doing interviews with the media, with you, with others. And then I was also traveling to various events. I was invited to a number of different events to really create relationships, to network, to begin to spread the word of the NCI beyond our borders and within our border, the US. In the process of all of that, I made some contacts in other countries and eventually started to build a kind of network. And this is what's happening right now, is that all of these different groups around the world are connecting with each other. And so I received an invitation to attend the leadership summit, which is part of the Geneva Project. So just to clarify, there's three parts. There's actually a convoy, a citizens convoy, that is being organized. It's basically just people in their cars. There's also this leadership summit happening on the Friday. And then there's the rally where all of us will meet on the Saturday. So I received this invitation for my work as the spokesperson for what they believe to be my ability to speak and make a difference, I guess is the simplest way to say it. It was an invitation and read it. It was an immediate yes for me, because the reason I took on being the spokesperson for the NCI is the same reason that I started my podcast, Trued Up. And that is because my goal is to build as many bridges as possible, to have people identify themselves as the ones who are going to make a difference, rather than looking to some hero or some politician or some other leader to make things happen. This has got to be something where each and every one of us takes personal responsibility. So that's one of the things about this project that appealed to me. The second thing was that while the resistance, while the defensive mode that we have been mostly operating under, you know, we've been reacting to policies, and while that's hugely important and in some ways effective, the next stage that the Geneva Project is standing in is creation. So rather than an anti-WHO rally, this is a celebration of our achievements thus far. It is a declaration that we are no longer interested in the WHO, and we are going to create our own alternatives that are based in what the people actually want.
Mm. You mentioned you're actually going to be reading from the NCI report. I mean, you just give us a little bit more detail about what you're going to be reciting.
So I will not be reading from the report. So there's kind of twofold. What I'm there for in this summit is to participate in a World Cafe conversation. So these are going to be conversations with all these different constituents from around the world: doctors, scientists, lawyers, media, different people from different geographical areas, from different walks of life. So all of these people involved in these roundtable conversations to spark ideas for how we create a new paradigm for health. So that's the first part. So I will be participating in that. The second part is there has been a declaration of independence, a declaration stating that we, the people of the world, are no longer interested in participating in organizations, unelected organizations like the WHO. So I haven't read it yet, but I have been asked to read part of that at the rally. Because I am going and am committed to sharing the commissioner's report, which is what I have been doing pretty much since the end of the hearings, I will be communicating with the people in attendance and giving them something so that they are aware of it. I will also want to try and get some interviews with people and talk to them on camera about the commissioner's report. Mm-hmm. So what is exciting for me is both to participate in a creative conversation, but also to share the work of the NCI, which in and of itself was a creative conversation. Like it was a new paradigm. We invented a whole new way to come together, to have our voices heard, to create a body of evidence. So this is unprecedented. I think just that we created a movement. We didn't wait for the government to do a COVID inquiry. We said, we're going to do this. We're going to find a way to do this. And that in and of itself is, I think, a shining example for the people at the Geneva Project.
Mm. Yeah. And you're going to leave here on Sunday night. And then I guess you're going to, before going to Geneva, you're going to go to the United Kingdom and other countries. People you expect to meet with or?
Yeah. So I am going to London. There, I am going to be meeting at least with one person who's involved with an organization there around health freedoms. And I'm hoping to meet with other people. We're trying to coordinate some things. On the Thursday morning, I am going to meet with the organizer of the Road to Geneva. So I want to do a live, hopefully, but at least something recorded at the very start of the convoy from London. Now, there'll be multiple starting points, but I will be there. I want to capture the beginning of that and share that with Canadians. Mm. And then from there that afternoon, I will fly to Geneva. The next day is the summit. The day after that is the rally.
Mm. And you mentioned a convoy going to Geneva. Is that like the convoy to Ottawa 2 years ago? Was that perhaps a Canada-influenced event as well?
Oh, absolutely. It's Canada influenced. I mean, all the convoys that have been happening around the world since the Freedom Convoy have been influenced by Canada. This one, however, is a citizens' convoy. So it's not, all trucks. It's not going to be all farmers. It'd be ordinary people driving their cars from various directions, taking various routes and ending up near Geneva. They've already spoken to a local town. There's a resort town near Geneva that is welcoming all the convoy participants. You know, this is because it's a resort town, it's off season. They're very happy to have all these people gathering there. So it's been very well coordinated from what I can tell. And so anybody can participate and people will be participating. I think it's going to be massive.
Now, in terms of the WHO's plans, I imagine that James Corbett, my colleague, his presentation was a major factor in your decision regarding going out there, or at least an informative aspect of it.
James gave one of the most comprehensive testimony about the WHO, and I encourage people to watch his testimony. You know, it's just such an excellent overview. There were many other people who testified who touched on it. But yeah, his was one of the biggest pieces. And as a result, there are several recommendations in the commissioner's report that touch on this issue. And in fact, the report does recommend exiting the pandemic treaty. It has several recommendations around the treaty.
Okay, well, do you know of anything in Canada? Do you know of any of the dangers are being registered in either in the mainstream media? I mean, I haven't seen that as far as I've seen, but or maybe I should say, has there been any attempt to engage Parliament in anything having to do with resisting the WHO's plans? Well, can you speak to that?
Well, Leslyn Lewis did have a petition that's got a lot of signatures. And I recommend that, you know, people, I'm not sure if it's still open, but you can, you know, look it up, Leslyn Lewis petition, WHO. I know that that was doing fairly well. I don't know where what the status of it is at this time, but that's the only thing I know of that has been opposing all of this.
Well, the pandemic treaty or the pandemic agreement and then the IHR revisions working together opens a kind of a Pandora's box to having the WHO, call a pandemic anytime, and then we would be subjected to more, potentially to more lockdowns, vaccine mandates, and as we witnessed with the truckers' convoy, potentially engaging more Emergencies Act legislation. I mean, that's kind of like, well, I'll have a talk about it in the next half hour, but and shutting down of people's access to finances, for example, mm-hmm. which is one of the things. Would you suggest that people listening to this program, at home, who maybe can't make it out to Geneva, what do you think they should do to put the brakes on this project, or else, as you say, try to find a more, an alternative moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things. One, contact your elected representatives. Register your displeasure with participating in the WHO pandemic treaty. Tell them that you do not want to participate in the treaty, that you do not support the amendments to the international health regulations. The other thing you can do is you can still participate in the Geneva project. So one of the things, aside from the practical World Cafe conversations, one of the reasons for this celebratory rally is to shift the energy in the world, because so many people are feeling like we are not gaining any ground, we are not winning. People are feeling demoralized and tired, and we have the capacity to shift the trajectory of this. We have the capacity to shift the energy. We are 8 billion people. There's a few thousand people who are trying to push this through. And I know the Geneva Project is asking people to walk. If you can't march in Geneva, you can march wherever you are. Go with a friend, go with a group of friends, go with a community, and march in the spirit of unity, in the spirit of creation. So if we can start in that place, we can begin to shift our own mindset. We can begin to shift from this very negative experience that we've had and turn it into something positive. And, we know it's going to take a lot more than that, but it's something that we actually can do.
Michelle, is there anything else you'd like to add before we close the interview?
I think the only thing I want to add is that I know that for most people, the World Health Organization seems like something far away and irrelevant to everyday life. But this is actually the greatest threat to democracy that we have ever experienced. And the only way out of it is for each of us to take personal responsibility for our health, our lives, our government, our society.
Well, Michelle, if you're standing for unity over tyranny, love over control, and letting the truth unite us, I wish you every good fortune in the week ahead. Thanks so much for joining me on the program.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for the work you're doing to share the information about what's happening in the WHO.
Been speaking with Michelle Leduc-Catlin. She's the former spokesperson for the National Citizens Inquiry, and she's on her way to Geneva, Switzerland next week.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
On the World Health Organization's website, it states that the WHO comprises over 8,000 professionals, including the world's leading public health experts. The World Health Assembly is the decision-making body for the WHO, and the 77th World Health Assembly meeting in Geneva meets from the 27th of May to June 1st. one might think that strengthening this body's authority might benefit the health of people around the world. But this body's dependability has come under intense scrutiny. One of those people scrutinizing them is Dr. Merrill Nass. Now, Dr. Merrill Nass is a National Merit Scholar. She's entered MIT before completing Biggs High School. She has a BS in biology in 1974 and then became a medical doctor in 1980. She was board certified in internal medicine in 1986, and she's practiced medicine for 41 years. She's traveled to 50 countries. She has two children and is a single parent. Among her accomplishments, she was the first person in the world to investigate an epidemic and prove it was due to biological warfare, which occurred in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, during its civil war, employing anthrax in 1992. She wrote the first review article on the anthrax vaccine in 1999. She helped lead a coalition to educate on anthrax vaccine and fight the military anthrax vaccine mandate from 1998 to 2004. She gave six testimonies to Congress on the anthrax vaccine, biological warfare, and Gulf War syndrome from 1999 to 2009. And she revealed the massive effort to suppress hydroxychloroquine use for COVID and in the U.S. and around the world in 2020. Starting in 2022, her medical license was suspended, supposedly for spreading misinformation about the COVID vaccines and providing early COVID treatment with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Dr. Mel Nass has been making frequent appearances to warn people about actions by the World Health Assembly to make serious moves at the end of this month to commandeer a coup against many of our prized human rights, supposedly in the interest of protecting us from the next pandemic. She joins us now to fill our listeners in on the aspects of WHO's power grab that should concern us and how we can all fight back. Dr. Merrill Nass, thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this week's discussion.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here. I love global research.
Thank you. The changes have been planned out for over a year now, I believe. I mean, the way the WHL sells it, they would prefer to streamline our approach so that the disastrous response to the last pandemic will not repeat itself. And there's no question of high death and mortality rates that followed. So trying to put through the changes to the way they act and advise, it would seem to be a great idea. But what concerns do you have about the specific changes the WHO has in mind?
Well, what the WHO has said is that we handled the pandemic so poorly last time that we need to do it better in future. We can't let this happen again. And so what they've suggested is that we centralize control into the WHO and let them manage pandemics going forward and other public health emergencies, quite a variety of public health emergencies. Now, the problem is that one of the reasons we did so poorly last time is because most countries were using the advice of the WHO, which, of course, you know, was not to use hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, to use remdesivir, you know, to lock down, all things that at least among those of us who looked very carefully, we feel were not helpful at all and probably actually contributed to the death rate. Another interesting thing is that the WHO normally is in favor of local control, you know, that projects should, or theoretically, they say projects shouldn't come from, you know, the global north, but should be the global south at the local level or the country level should determine what projects they need to improve health in their country. And yet this plan of the WHO is so centralized that basically everybody in the world would be given the same instructions. Let me also say that even though the WHO, as you read initially, claims to have the public health expertise that's the best in the world, they don't. They have a bunch of pamphleteers. They have people who can write copy. They have a very hierarchical system. You know, nobody's allowed to say anything until it's approved by committees. And they have a few physicians who haven't practiced medicine in many years, you know, like Mike Ryan. Who are the others? I can't think of their names right now. And they've got some PhDs. But these people really do not know much about medicine on the ground and what developing nations or anyone else needs. Mike Ryan, they are administrators. They are money people. And as I said, they did everything wrong during COVID. And why they think they should get any authority to make any decisions for anybody else's health is sort of beyond me and beyond anyone who looks at these documents.
So you say they're not really just actual doctors. They're more like, I guess, pencil pushers who sit behind a desk and go for that sort of thing. That kind of experience is what they benefit from or something like that.
Correct. I mean, Africa had the largest two Ebola epidemics ever were in 2014 in West Africa and 2018 and 2019 in East Africa. And the WHO would not declare them, would not help. And finally, after about 10 months of each one going on, the WHO gave them some help, but it wasn't on the ground help. The WHO did not send people there to actually try to fix things. They came up with policies, you know, and maybe a bit of money and a bit of resources. But they have failed at when they've tried to help manage pandemics. The WHO declared a pandemic in 2009 for swine flu, which triggered the activated contracts for vaccines for swine flu that were worth tens of billions of dollars, that the WHO had initiated, had been basically the broker for nations and pharmaceutical companies who had signed contracts, sleeper contracts, contracts that nobody knew about, saying that when the WHO director general declared a pandemic in future, these contracts would be triggered and nations would be obligated to buy whatever amount of vaccines at whatever price had already been established. So this was triggered in 2009, only weeks after the definition of a pandemic, a level six pandemic, had been changed, such that any cold, any new virus, and we have new viruses every day of the week, any new virus could be declared a pandemic. And so, you know, billions of people were vaccinated for a flu that was milder than a normal seasonal flu. Well over 1,000 people developed narcolepsy as a result of their pandemics, swine flu vaccinations. And those vaccines were given a liability shield so that the people who were harmed had nobody to sue. And that is exactly what the WHO is trying to bring forward now. They want all the nations in the treaty, they want all nations to pass laws enabling unlicensed, rapidly produced vaccines to be rolled out for their entire population with a liability shield. So the same thing that happened in 2009 happened again for COVID, liability shield, because you can't roll out a vaccine in a few weeks and expect it to work or expect it to be safe. It's never happened in the history of the world. It's never happened. And so if you're going to roll it out, you've got to put a liability shield on it because no manufacturer is going to be willing to take that risk. But they're perfectly happy to have the citizens take the risk.
So something about the WHO. I mean, I know like when it was created back about, you know, 70 something years ago. I mean, it wasn't that bad, right? It was something that was basically helping fund, basically allowing resources to fund the poorer countries. But something happened between, you know, the 20th century when there were basically maybe three epidemics to a whole series of them. You know, SARS, and the pandemics that you just mentioned. Basically gearing them to, you know, leaning towards more vaccination, essentially.
So what's happened is that the way of funding the WHO changed. over time. So over the last, say, 25 years, the WHO decided there should be public-private partnerships, and then that there should be a WHO foundation. And these were ways of bringing in money from, you know, corporations and philanthropies. And so currently, 85% of the WHO's budget comes from donations rather than from dues. So the member nations pay 15% of the budget. And Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, Rockefeller Foundation, Wellcome Trust, pharmaceutical companies, and nations, particularly nations with pharmaceutical industries, also donate. And so that is the funding stream. And so clearly, the people who pay the most to the WHO have the most opportunity to influence its decisions. And so the WHO, when it has its meetings and decides its program of work, et cetera, people at the table are not just the nation states, but they are also the stakeholders, the donors. So, you know, people from Bill Gates' operation are there at the table almost all the time. And when the WHO actually needs real experts, they often come from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or other philanthropies, because unlike their claim, they do not have medical expertise. There's a lot of expertise they don't have. What that means is that for countries to decide to turn over decisions, massively important decisions, such as whether everybody in the world is going to be mandated to get an experimental vaccine for which there's no liability, or whether the whole world will be locked down, why would you allow an unaccountable, unelected organization that gets most of its funds from private sources, why would you allow that institution to issue orders for the whole world?
Yeah. So basically, you're talking about something like a pharmaceutical industrial complex or a pandemic industrial complex, as opposed to the military industrial complex. There's a whole new section that has a devotion towards, you know, profit making ahead of, you know, health promotion.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have believed it myself. I knew there was corruption in the medical system for sure. But the extent of the corruption, you know, the fact that these companies would be happy to roll out vaccines that they knew didn't work or were harmful, and would keep rolling them out. And here we are, you know, 3.5 years later, and they're still rolling them out. I had no idea anything like that could happen. And 2/3 of the world population has been given a COVID vaccine, and none of them work for, you know, more than a few months at the outside. And then they start to make you more susceptible to COVID. And then there's a, you know, the panoply of horrendous side effects that they can cause. And that's every manufacturer, I think, because they're modeled on a spike protein, which in itself is highly toxic. So the normal way to make a vaccine, you don't use the toxic part of the bacteria or the virus. Or if you do, you modify it and get rid of the epitopes, the parts of it that give it toxicity. That was not done in this case. So everybody was injected with an antigen that was highly toxic. Why that was done, you know, we don't know yet. Nobody's tried to explain it. Now, you know, did the U.S. government give the recipe to Pfizer and to Moderna? Who came up with these recipes that did not modify the toxic portions of the spike protein? Or were there other parts of the virus that could have been used instead? Questions that really aren't being raised in the mainstream media.
Mm. And I'm wondering if you could just go over some of the, I guess, more onerous aspects of the amendments to the international health regulations and the pandemic agreement that's being put forward, and how that would subtract from us our human rights.
Thank you. So we've had about 9 versions of the pandemic treaty, now called the pandemic agreement. It's had 5 names. And we've had 3 versions of the amendments to the international health regulations. And we don't have a final version of either document. Oh. So what I'm telling you now is based on what's been in the majority of drafts of these two documents, but may not be there when they finally vote, if they vote, because they often avoid a vote and claim that they have a consensus. So the WHO would be able to impose lockdowns. So borders could be closed. Everything we experienced with the lockdowns before could happen again. Schools could be closed, businesses could be closed, et cetera. Masks could be instituted, vaccines could be mandated. The chief scientist who has been brought into the WHO a year ago is Jeremy Farrar. He was previously the director of the Wellcome Trust, and he and Bill Gates created a charitable organization, so-called charitable, called CEPI, Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation, whose goal is to roll out vaccines for emergencies in, develop them in 100 days, manufacture them in 30 more days, and at the end of 130 days, get them to everybody in the country. There's no possibility of testing those vaccines in humans at that rate of speed. And so Jeremy Farrar being moved to the WHO means that, even though the documents don't say a vaccines to be pushed out in 130 days, everybody knows that is, in fact, what the plan is. In addition, there is a requirement for nations to control misinformation and disinformation. So nations will have to perform surveillance of all their citizens' social media and censor them, just as has happened, but worse. So it won't only be YouTube censoring us, but it'll be, you know, it'll include Twitter and everything else. There are two particularly dangerous provisions. One is called One Health. It's a very bizarre concept. Hasn't really been explained well. There have been 61 published definitions. It is some method by which you balance and evaluate the health of humans, plants, animals, and ecosystems together. And that doesn't seem to make any sense, and it doesn't. But many billions of dollars have been pumped into this strange concept. And so there are One Health divisions in public health offices around the world, in universities around the world. And there have been many grants paid to scientists to write articles about how they use the One Health approach in one way or another. And unfortunately, The Lancet, that has a One Health commission, and I don't know who paid for that, Lancet has had a hard time being able to find any evidence that this approach works well for anything. But what's happened is that basically everything in the world has been put into the One Health basket, because if you include animals, plants, ecosystems, and humans, that's everything. And it's a mechanism for saying everything in the world is related to health, and now the WHO can issue orders to the world to manage climate emergencies or ecosystem emergencies or gun violence or problems with the food supply, bird flu. Okay, therefore we have to cull all the birds.
Oh, my goodness. So you're saying that you don't even necessarily have to prove that there is a pandemic, but you could say anything about climate
That's
change,
correct.
Clean water, whatever.
These documents initially said the director general of WHO could either declare a pandemic or the potential for a pandemic. People didn't like the term potential, so in the last draft, it's called a likely pandemic, which is the same thing. And he can determine when the pandemic is over. So he can extend it beyond what most people would think would be the end of the pandemic. That's in the health regulation amendments. In the treaty is actually active 24/7 all the time. So the WHO would be able to issue orders all the time if those issues are contained in the treaty, and One Health is in the treaty. The other bad part of this is something called the BioHub system, the BioHub network, and the pathogen access and benefit sharing system, which demands that nations find potential pandemic pathogens, which I call potential biological warfare agents, collect them, study them, create labs for studying them, sequence them, and then send the WHO specimens and sequences, and the WHO will share them widely around the world. So this is basically a proliferation of biological weapons. It's against the law, but the WHO doesn't bother with the law. And it's also a way that we can, because there are always accidents in laboratories, the United States reports 200 accidents using these potential pandemic pathogens in labs every year. We have about 200 reported accidents. And so demanding that every other country have these same labs is an invitation to many accidents, and presumably there will be many more pandemics.
My goodness. Well, there has been resistance to this, apparent changing of the guard of the WHO and the way they operate. So they're not just an advisory body, they're a governing body, right?
They would be, WHO would transition to be a governing body.
Wow. Now, major resistance has been registered already in the United States, for example. Could you talk about some of the victories that have already come forward, or partial victories, in response to this WHO order?
Yes. So we've had amazing victories in the U.S. So first off, 49 senators, every Republican senator, has sent a letter to the president and co-sponsored a bill demanding that these treaties be put before the Senate for ratification. Now, most people think all treaties go before the Senate for ratification because that's what the Constitution says. But in fact, for 200 years, most of them have not. They have been signed off by the executive branch. So this would demand that it go before the Senate. And if we can get this done, so the Biden administration doesn't want it to go before the Senate, and it will require a law making it go in front. And we've got 49 senators in favor. We've got 50 some odd House members who have co-sponsored a bill doing the same thing. We need to get two additional senators who are not Republicans, and then we can pass this law, and then we can kill these treaties, at least for the United States, at the level of the Senate. We've also had 22 attorneys general send a letter to the president saying that actually, according to the Constitution, the states have authority for health, not the president. And they do not agree with transferring that authority to the WHO, and they do not plan to carry out either direct or indirect orders from the WHO on health.
That was just a few weeks ago?
That was on May 8th, so okay. 2 weeks ago. Tomorrow. And the senator's letter was on May 1st. Okay. We also have several states that have passed legislation that will protect them. Florida actually did last year. Utah passed legislation that will protect them in January. And Louisiana passed legislation in the Senate, and it's passed in the House. And there was a slight change to bring the date it becomes active on to the date of signing by the governor. And it went to the governor yesterday. So and the governor is in favor. So we're expecting that Louisiana will have this law in place, sometime this week. And there are several other states that have passed resolutions or are in the process of passing bills to deny jurisdiction to the WHO or to direct the president not to obey the WHO. And so those are big victories. We've had a number of countries say that they don't like these treaties. However, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, who came out about 10 days ago, 11 days ago, and said Slovakia would not be signing the treaties as they're currently written. 5 days later, there was an assassination attempt on his life, and he's been in the intensive care unit ever since with multiple close-range bullet wounds. And Iran was one of 11 countries that had written to the UN in September, not going along with this plan. And the president and the foreign minister of Iran died in a helicopter crash 2 days ago.
Wow.
So I would advise heads of state to not, even though I asked them previously to publicly state what they would do ahead of time to give other countries countries don't like to go out on a limb on their own. They want company. But I would say, don't go out on a limb right now and say how your nation is going to vote. Instead, demand a roll call vote. That means every diplomat that votes yes or no has to have their vote recorded. And so that diplomat and that country can be held accountable for their vote. This is something the WHO does not like to do, but it's absolutely necessary when we're talking about transferring sovereignty, transferring governance to this unaccountable international organization. People who vote yes need to be accountable. And so it's very important that we get a real vote and that we know how everyone voted. What else can I tell you?
Well, I think maybe in about 30 seconds or so, is there anything, if listeners haven't gotten involved up until now, is it too late to take action? Because it's starting early next week. I mean, are there still measures that we could take to?
Well, there's still measures that, because the treaties need to be ratified, even if the United States signs up to them, we can still have the Senate ratify. And so it's very important to contact your representatives and senators. Now, if you've got Republican senators, they've already signed on to this. But if you've got non-Republican senators, please urge them to pay close attention to this. It's really critically important for our freedoms going forward. I mean, I can't tell you how critical this issue really is. This is the first real big play by globalists to start centralizing control over the entire world. Mm. Call your representative. If they are a co-sponsor of Bill H.R. 1425, Tom Tiffany's bill to require Senate ratification, thank them if they're a co-sponsor. If they're not, beg them to please co-sponsor it and vote in favor. Because if we can get this in front of the Senate for ratification, it dies and we are saved here in the United States. Now, if you're in other countries, you demand the same thing of your leaders. You don't want this in any country. So I hope you will work with me. DoorToFreedom.org is an organization I founded a year ago to get information about what is going on to people. We have a ton, all kinds of information available that could be read by 12-year-olds or college professors. We have videos, we have handouts, you name it, we've got it. And we've got copies of all the documents, every draft of every treaty. If you want to read them yourself, we would encourage that. And I thank you, Michael.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Merrill Nass. And good best of luck, best wishes going into next week and beyond.
Thank you. Thanks again. Bye-bye now.
Dr. Merrill Nass is a physician and researcher. Her website is merylnass.substack.com. That's our show for this week. Next week, we will investigate the many mysterious deaths of world leaders and the near death of another to determine whether this is coincidence or a surge in covert deep state activities. Join us in 7 days. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.
CKUW 95.9 FM, homegrown in Winnipeg, Manitoba.